according to the police officer I spoke to, they went through a list of questions in order to ascertain whether or not she was safe and determined that she was okay to be on her own on the streets of Victoria, barefoot in November, and they left her there. That was the last time anyone ever saw her.
You are listening to Emma Filipov is Missing, an ongoing series by the Nighttime Podcast.
When I launched the Nighttime Podcast, I intended to choose several stories that were especially deep and revisit them. My ultimate goal was to form several ongoing stories to break up my typical one topic per episode approach. The disappearance of Emma Filipov is certainly one of these cases I've been revisiting. Up to this point, I've released 3 episodes covering Emma's troubling story. The first was the introduction to the case, told by her mother Shelley. The second included a deeper examination of the details of the disappearance, and the third included a long-form interview with the often-considered suspect, Julian. When I looked back at these 3 episodes, I'm satisfied in how Emma's story came out, but I can't help but feel there's something missing. As cliche as it sounds, I think what's missing is Emma. Throughout this series, the majority of the discussion focused on the details of her disappearance in the events of her last known days. Although we did discuss her personality in a basic sense, what I realize is that I know a lot about Emma's disappearance, but I'm far from understanding her. This was the motivation behind the next series of episodes I've been preparing concerning the disappearance of Emma Filipov. My goal is to provide a more detailed picture of who Emma is and how her personality evolved over time. To provide the necessary perspective, I reached out to a number of people close to Emma and invited them to share their stories with you. Through the resulting conversations, I believe an authentic portrait of Emma will emerge, but also I expect her slowly degrading mental health to become more obvious. I'll be releasing these episodes in a sort of chronological order. I've organized them based on when our guests in Emma's lives were the closest. When choosing a guest to share Emma's story, I wanted to find someone who was close to Emma during her childhood. I was very fortunate to get in touch with Ellen. She's a lifelong best friend of Emma's who's been with her since elementary school. Anyone who's been following Emma's case may already have been introduced to our guest Ellen, as she's participated in the CBC-produced documentary Finding Emma. To give Ellen her proper introduction, I'll play an excerpt from a recent conversation I had with Emma's mother, Shelley Filipov. During my talk with Shelley, I asked her to tell me about the relationship Emma and Ellen share.
Emma and Ellen had a very special, very close relationship. They met in French immersion. Our school system has it set up so that you move from one school to another when you go into grade 5 French immersion. So they had been in separate schools, but when the immersion option came along, they both opted for it. And Ellen was 10 and Emma was a year ahead, so Emma was 9. And they became very close friends very quickly. They both belonged to a large social group, but there was something special about Ellen, and she and Ellen developed a relationship that I would say was akin to sisters. They found everything funny. They laughed all the time. They must have driven their teachers crazy because they were constantly fine. They just found life wonderful and funny and entertaining. So that's how they met. That friendship has endured throughout the years. Up until Emma went missing, they were still as close as ever, despite living in opposite ends of the country. When they got together, it was as if they had never been apart.
Now that we've been introduced to Ellen and Emma's relationship, I'll now play my recent conversation with Ellen.
I'm Ellen, and I'm a close long-term friend of Emma's. We grew up together in the same small town.
Do you recall even roughly when you first met her?
Yeah, so the way that things work in our town is that there's a number of really small schools all outside of the main town of Perth. And when students hit grade five, they start getting bused into town if they're going to do French immersion, which is really common for the students. So when we were in grade five, Emma transferred from the smaller, sort of more rural school she was at into the public school in Perth. So we would have been in grade five, which is, I don't know, maybe 12 years old.
Can you describe getting to know her and maybe telling me what led you to become so close?
Yeah, so actually when Emma came to the school, we hated each other. We were very, very different people. So she was at that sort of life stage. She was very feminine. And I was the complete opposite. I was really, really into playing soccer, baseball, and really any sport that I could play. But like, if you can imagine, essentially, I was like the kid with scraped up knees and would come home kind of like with dirt in my hair from like whenever I got up to at recess. And she was like, like quite pristine, well-dressed and really kind of put together. Yeah. So it's quite opposites at the time. Yeah.
What do you think it was that led you to get along so great and eventually become such close friends?
You know, I don't know why it happened, but we were in the same class together, and our teacher sent us both across the hall to work in this little room, like, you know, about 5 feet by 5 feet. It was like a room used for the canteen, so for selling sort of snacks at lunch. But we ended up having to go over there for a little bit every day to do some work. And at some point we started singing in that room, and we just got hooked on the way our voices sounded in that room. Neither of us were singers, neither of us sang in public or had any interest in doing that, but we started going over into the singing room every day, which is what we called it, and requesting to get sent over there. So, you know, convincing our teacher that actually the best work was done when the two of us could go over into that room and sing.
I guess this would have been at the end of elementary or junior high school at this point.
Yeah. So our schools went like kindergarten to grade eight and then straight into high school.
During this part of Emma's life, like during high school, can you describe her personality and maybe like the kind of things you would do together when you were spending time?
Yeah. I spent some time today reflecting on and thinking about our friendship at that time. And I think the best way I can describe it is that our friendship brought out our silliest selves. Differing from other relationships we had and who we were expected to be as students, when we got together, we were ridiculous and silly and sort of took any excuse to play or to dress up or to sing. We at some point started this narrative that actually we were twins separated at birth, and our parents were, I really don't know where this came from, but our parents were actually Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman, who were like fairly big movie stars at the time. Mm-hmm. And this was like the big secret that no one knew. So we would make up these stories and these worlds and these games. I think that really captures who she was then. Quite silly. But there also was the other side to her, which is that she's always been a very artistic person, both through like photography and drawing and writing poetry. And that was always kind of the quieter, private side of her. And that was kind of her alone time.
You said it was more in her private, quiet time. Was she like that? Like, was she the type that was often talking about, you know, her poetry and sharing her artwork or whatnot? Or was this something that she just kind of went off on her own and did?
I would sometimes get to read her writing because we were in class together. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at that time, she would have to write pieces for English class, or we had to write poetry for English class. And so then I would be like, maybe a little more privy to it. But I think it was mostly something that she did on her own for herself.
So Emma lived with you for a period of time, I understand. I think during high school. Can you describe that and maybe tell me what led to it?
Sure. I think that actually all through elementary school and into high school, we both spent a lot of time at each other's houses. So our house was kind of always that spot with an open door. And then what happened when we were about 16, which we thought we were more like 21, we were sure we had everything figured out, and only really in hindsight can I recognize that actually we were still kids at that time. Emma really didn't want to have anything to do with curfews or rules around where she could be and when she could be there. And so she decided that she was going to move out of her parents' house. She told them that she really didn't want a curfew, and they really wanted her to have that safety around her of things like a curfew. So she decided she was moving out, and the natural place for her to go was to come to my house. And so even though I'm sure her parents were scared about her deciding to move out, it actually was probably the safest place and a comfort for them to know that she was with us, which meant that Shelly could call up my mom and ask, you know, how things were going, or she could call up and talk to Emma. But it also meant that she now was just under someone else's rules. Very similarly, my mom wanted to keep her safe, and so enforced a curfew. And so it wasn't too long that until she decided to get her own apartment in town.
The average 16-year-old would have issues with curfew and rules and whatnot, but it would be unusual to actually leave the house. At the time, did you remember her like any specific reason she had such a difficult time dealing with the curfew? Or was she just, I'm just thinking, like, was she someone who was very rebellious, or was there some other reason she had such a hard time dealing with it?
It's a little hard to pull it apart now because so much time has passed, but honestly, I think it was pretty regular teenage stuff, which is that she felt really strongly about being able to have her independence. She felt really strongly about being able to stay out all night if she chose to. So, you know, with her going missing, sometimes I want to read into all different things, but I think this was fairly typical. And you're right, it's a bit atypical to actually follow through, but also the follow through was to this safety net you already had, right? Follow through was to this house that you had spent a lot of time. She had, you know, really strong relationships with my parents and with my sister as well. And so it wasn't too much of a jump.
Yeah, it was already kind of set up, so it wasn't that big of a deal for her to go with it. Like, I guess it would have been a big deal if it was anyone other than your family.
Yeah, and so I would say the bigger jump was to actually go and get an apartment. That was, you know, none of our other friends at 16 had an apartment. When I think back at it, I think that after she got her own apartment, she missed some of the aspects of a family home. Like the Filipovs family home was warm and lively and full. So there's four kids, and they always had friends there. And in later years, they had three large dogs that I can't remember who, but someone brought home like some rescue puppies that they were meant to just foster, and then they fell in love with these dogs. So like a really loud, warm, lively family home. Like, I remember thinking, that's the type of home that I see on TV.
So speaking to that point, can you describe Emma's relationship with her family and as well as how she described her relationship with her family to you?
Emma's relationship with her family was that she had a different relationship with each individual member of the family. So she like connected on different things. She had different jokes. they also like came together as a unit, but it was always neat to watch those relationships. And they, you know, since I have known her since we were so young, then those relationships have changed as well. You know, as her younger brothers got older and they, you know, switched from being sort of that sibling to developing friendships. I think that Shelley has spoken about him as well, but in particular, Emma's relationship with her youngest brother was quite maternal. She was quite a bit older, and so she had a maternal like bond with him that she really wanted to like care for him. And he had, you know, when he would have the place that he practiced karate would have bring your parent to karate night, and he would bring Emma and I, because we just, you know, we loved doing those kind of things with him, and we would take him to every time a Harry Potter movie came out. We would take him to the theater and like try to bring one of his friends as well. But just they had a really strong connection, and I think with her dad, she shared a lot of her artistic side. So he's an artist, and I think she always really respected and looked to him to share that part of her. And her mom was very involved in our day-to-day life. So her mom was a teacher at the school that we went to together from grade 5 to grade 8. And she was our teacher and quite present and, you know, someone who was really involved in the day-to-day.
Now, you would have been close with Emma during the time that her parents separated. Now, many people look to this as kind of a turning point in Emma's life. I'm just wondering if you can talk about how Emma reacted with her parents' separation, and maybe if you could share anything she would have told you about that, or how she spoke about it.
I think it was a big upset for her. I think that it was hard for her to know where she should be and what she should do, and just changed some of the, you know, some of the things that had stayed sort of the same and stable throughout her life, like her parents living in their family home outside of town. I think that the change in itself was a big upset.
Do you recall seeing any shift in Emma or any change in Emma after the separation?
So there was a time after where she had already been out west for a little while, and she flew home, and I picked her up from the airport, and this was after her parents' separation, and she came and she stayed with me for a little while. I was in Ottawa at the time, and she came, she stayed with me, and I remember her not really wanting to leave my place. And I, you know, we both knew that eventually she was going to have to go to Perth, and she wanted to go to Perth and wanted to see her family, but she just didn't quite actually take action to do it. Until I said, okay, I'm going to take you to Perth tonight. We're going to go have dinner at my parents' house. And then I'm going to take you to your dad's house. And I described that not because she didn't want to go to Perth and she didn't want to see her family. She did. I think it was confusing for her to be going home to this quite different environment and going to her dad's place in town rather than the family home. And I think it was scary and confusing for her.
Over the years, from you knowing her from around grade 5 up until ultimately when she had disappeared in Victoria, can you describe how her personality changed over the years, and maybe give some examples of times that you remember noticing this gradual change?
Right from when we were quite young, Emma was a private person. So she had a lot of people close to her, and the people that were close to her, she trusted. She kept journals when she was quite young. And that was always something that was quite private, like differing from her coming into my world and coming into my room and sort of everything was fair game. That's something that I never would have done, is to go into her room and open her art book or open up one of her journals without her even having to say that. It was really quite clear that there was a line, and that she had elements of her life that was just for her. And then I now pull out these shifts when I look back, where I would say that need for privacy got bigger. She actually had less and less stuff as she got older. You hear a lot of people talking about these jeans that she wore, that she just, every time they would get a hole, she would patch them. And she loved her pants. They were part of her story, like something that was with her always. And I would say she started to keep few things, but keep them really close to her. So she would almost always have her backpack on, and in it, she would really have her important things. And so to me, that time was a shift when, like, a need for privacy, which I think we all have and have private things, sort of started to tip over into what feels more like secrecy. And she sort of tightened her circle around her. So more in her adult years, if she told me what she was going to do the next day, she would often remind me too many times to not tell anyone. For example, she would say, like, oh, tomorrow I'm going to go to the quarry with my dad, but don't tell anyone, okay? To the point that it felt funny. Honestly, it felt frustrating to me. I would sort of quip back, like, who am I going to tell and who cares? But she really needed to say it. And I would say those were, like, the first signs of it being more than just regular need for privacy.
Mm-hmm. And was it specific to being private about where she was going to be and what she was thinking? Or was it all aspects of her life she just wanted to, I guess, keep to herself and her close circle?
All, definitely most aspects of her life. I remember we went to the movies one day. It probably was with her youngest brother, but we went to the movies and we were going into the movie, and then she got it in her head that she left her car unlocked. And I didn't want to go back to the car, but she was insistent on it. So we had to go back to the car and double check that it was locked. And it felt like she was really worried about her things in the car. Not because they had financial value, but because they were, like, they were hers and they were private. So I'd say a lot around sort of the security of the things she needed to live her life, which was, you know, her couple articles of clothing and, you know, some toiletries and maybe a passport, you know. So these were the things that she kept really close and kept in her backpack and really were, you know, nothing that, as a friend, I wouldn't just, like, go into her backpack to find something that would feel like I'm sort of, you know, walking into a locked room, you know, really invading on her space. Not that she would have to tell me that, it just felt that way.
Interesting. Now, getting to Julian, you would have been, I believe, around at the time that she spent, or during some of the time that she spent with Julian. Have you met him? And what do you remember about his relationship with Emma?
Yeah, I met Julian, and actually, in listening to him speaking on the earlier podcast, actually, I think I must have met him the first weekend they met. I definitely met him at the music festival, which happens once a year in Perth. And I remember they were soaking wet, and Emma was, like, very excited to come and tell me that they had jumped in the river, which, honestly, it's kind of a dirty river. I mean, it's a slightly polluted river. So she thought it was hilarious because most people don't swim in it anymore. And so I met him then. Honestly, it's not something that I would have remembered, except for that I got a message from him on Facebook after Emma went missing, just kind of saying he was concerned. And he wrote in that message, actually, that we had met at Stuart Park Festival. So now, sort of putting all the pieces together, I realized that was the weekend they met as well.
But after initially probably meeting him that weekend, did you have any involvement with him during his and Emma's relationship? And he described on my show, like, the long walks at night they took together and whatnot. Like, were you a party to any of these types of events?
No, I wasn't living in town then. So really, we only crossed paths that one time in town, but it definitely was something that at that time she walked a lot at night. She really wasn't sleeping a lot, and would just walk and walk and walk.
Were these long walks something you ever talked about with Emma, or was that just the normal thing she did at that time? Like, it sounds unusual now looking back, but at the time, as your friend was going for these long walks and not sleeping well, how was that talked about?
You know, we would talk about it as it was without necessarily, like, digging too deep into it. I'm always both an incredibly typical, normal kid in some ways, and also not typical. And this was sort of, it didn't feel that out of the ordinary for her to do that kind of thing. You know, as a friend, I was always trying to encourage her to be healthy, and to me, that sleep is an important part of that. Actually, at that time, we were planning a month-long bike trip down the West Coast, which never came to be. But at that time, we were planning that, and so we were talking a little bit about, you know, the needing to be strong for it, which means being healthy and sleeping and eating and all of those things.
Now, getting back to Julian, some people will talk about his relationship with Emma maybe leading to her suffering from such extreme paranoia, but it sounds to me she was showing some traits of being paranoid before being involved with Julian or meeting Julian. Is that accurate to say?
I think so. I think that it was definitely something that was coming out more and more, is these feelings of the need for privacy, which now in hindsight feel a lot more like paranoia to me. And I don't really know what part Julian played in it, because I really wasn't there. I do know that people were mesmerized by her. They were really drawn into her, and I hear that from what I've heard him say. Is she really did have that charm that sort of drew people to want to be around her in any capacity.
Now, what do you remember about her move to British Columbia? Do you recall this time and why she did go there?
She originally moved out west to go to school on Vancouver Island. And actually my older sister, who was also very close with Emma, drove out west with her. And I was at university in Waterloo. And so they drove from Perth to Waterloo and then stopped over for a few days. And it was quite a funny time. It was right before Emma's birthday. And she's never really been big on birthdays. And so they were on this mission to avoid her birthday altogether. And so they were kind of hiding out in Waterloo, and we were, you know, doing a lot of cooking together and hanging out. And there was this undecided date that they were going to continue on their way. And my guess would be that the whole trip went like that. I just kind of got to see that one snapshot of it. Is kind of this trip where you kind of get to move when you want to move and stop when you want to stop. The other quite funny thing about the trip is that actually Emma had to do a calculus course before she was eligible for the school that she was enrolled in, which was like a cooking school,
okay,
to become a chef. And so on this journey that they were taking, they also were studying, and my sister was helping her through her calculus program. And actually, I think a lot of that, I think Shelley was backing some of that. She was really interested in my sister helping Emma to get this calculus done. And so she was a big encouragement of this trip.
Now, when Emma was out west, be it in Vancouver at school or in Victoria, how did you stay in touch? Was it, you know, telephone calls, chatting on the internet? What were your conversations like?
We mostly used email. Sometimes she would call me, but we mostly connected through email. Her emails were often written in poem and were somewhat cryptic. So it was a little hard to know how they connected with actually what her life looked like there.
Can you give an example of the type of email you would have gotten from Emma?
Yeah, I was looking at them today and thinking about this, and one of them was about being at the School of Duel, she called it. And it was a school where people went to learn how to sword fight. But she just wrote me this long cryptic poem about Princess Bride, which is a movie we both really liked, and learning how to recreate the scene, because it's something we would, throughout our life, just recreate the scenes of that movie, and we sort of knew it word for word. And so she just sent me a poem all about that, and about going to one of the classes.
So she would, within these poems, she would actually describe, you know, what her day-to-day was like, or describe an event in her life?
Yeah. Do you want to hear a bit of one?
I would love to.
Okay, so this one says, "Hey man, oh, I don't know, I'm on the island on a great journey. Learning, learning, learning. Writing, reading, painting, creating, seeing, dreaming. Every day is a surprise. Every day I find treasures and truths, and life is strange and life is beautiful. How are you? How's your brain? So long as one day we're able to sword fight again. Love you, dude. Miss you."
And when did she write you that?
That was very end of May in 2012. And, you know, in hindsight now, I know she was staying at a shelter at that time. I don't know, right at that time, but around that time anyways. No, but also still, like, exploring and finding sort of journeys to be on.
Through these emails that she sent you when she was in Victoria and even in Vancouver prior to that, did you see, or could you tell that her mental health seemed to be deteriorating?
No, it wasn't obvious in the emails. She did come home a couple of times since she moved out west that first time. And I would say that it was more obvious in her coming home, but really not to the extent that, like, that I know now. Mm-hmm. You know, and it feels like she knew who would know and stayed quite far away.
In hindsight, is that what you think she was doing in Victoria, kind of just hiding out from everybody, kind of to keep her, what she was suffering from, private?
I don't know if it's the only thing that she was doing out there, but I think that's part of it.
What do you know about her time in Victoria, aside from the fact that the things you've learned after about, you know, living in the shelter and whatnot? But at the time, what did she share with you about what she was doing there? Or was it just these emails with little snapshots of the adventure she was on?
Yeah, that's it. Really, it's just and not that many of them. You know, maybe every 4 months we would send one back and forth. For years, we had that type of relationship where we would go, you know, a period of time. But as soon as she would, you know, fly home, I'd pick her up at the airport. We would pick up exactly where we left off. But she, you know, she was someone who was pretty present in where she was, which I think is part of the mesmerizing quality of her. Is if you were in a conversation with her, then she's in that, you know, her. She doesn't have a phone that's beeping. She doesn't have somewhere to run off to. She would often kind of keep things quite flexible so that she could do what she was doing at that moment. And so it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't unusual that I couldn't text her, or that you know, if one of us emailed the other, it wasn't unusual for us to take a while to get back to them.
So the last message you had read to me from the email from Emma, I think you said was around May of 2012. Leading up to November, ultimately when she disappeared from Victoria, were her messages seemingly different in tone, or can you describe kind of the last messages she would have received from Emma leading up to her disappearance?
Yeah, that was my last email from her.
What you had just read to me was the last, and was that in May, did you say?
Yeah, very end of May.
Were people in touch with her leading up to November?
No. And really, it would, from home, it would likely be my sister or I. We sort of stayed really close with her. And so it would be us, and we hadn't heard anything.
If Emma was to confide in someone with a problem she was having, would it reasonably be yourself or your sister that she would turn to, or would she even be the type that would turn to someone for help?
If she was having a problem and like wanted and needed the help, then I would say my sister or I, or like her parents or her siblings. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been really consistent people in her life. Going back a bit to what I was saying before about her sort of being in that present time, she also might tell someone who is around her.
Like she would be the type to just meet someone and open up.
To be honest, that's what I meant when I said it. But it doesn't ring true when I hear it back. But I think mostly because she didn't reach out. I think a lot of things she kept inside of her. I think that she would think and want to deal with it on her own.
Now, could you describe what you recall from initially after her disappearance? Like maybe tell me about first learning of Shelley's search for Emma.
So the morning that I found out, I was in grad school at the time, and I was only maybe a month and a half in, and it was a Saturday morning, I guess, and I was going into the lab. I had lab access hours, and I got a phone call from another really good friend of ours who grew up just down the road from Emma, and she said, Emma's missing. And I immediately, I was like, what? I don't understand. Like, I'm just running out the door. I kind of like, I both didn't understand, and I feel like I didn't really know where to put what she was saying. So she told me to go to the computer and to Google Emma. And then all the news articles started coming up of her being missing. And then that's where it started to sort of feel real. But actually I got my lab coat and I got picked up by a friend and I went into the lab because it felt like there was nothing else that I could do. And sort of went through my day a bit like a zombie, just sort of taking steps forward in order to try to sort out in my head what this could mean.
Would it have been in her personality to just, you know, just disappear off the grid?
So Emma was both a very transient person in that she liked to go where she wanted to go, when she wanted to go. It sounds just like when she was 16 and had a curfew. Mm-hmm. But it really, that was, you know, a consistent characteristic of her. It was partially a 16-year-old, but even as an adult, she really wanted to take opportunities as they came up and go and do it. And so for that first little while, I thought like a friend came along and offered her to go out on the boat for a week, and she took it. You know, I'd play through all these ideas in my head because selfishly, as I got more and more worried for her. I also got worried that she would just show up the next week and that I'd be furious with her. And as much as she was a transient person and liked to be able to go where she wanted, when she wanted, she actually always has been grounded to some relationships. Like, she's never not told people if she was going to, you know, go somewhere, go away for a while or leave the country. Like, her relationships were quite important to her. And, you know, I go back to it, but her relationship with her youngest brother was one that she cared so much about and was maternal in it. And so she's never just disappeared. You know, she's always checked in with people. And so it's this, you know, it's the two sides to everything, right? Is that, yes, she was transient, but also she cared really deeply in the relationships that she had and knew people cared about her and worried about her and would need to know these things.
During the time that Shelley was searching for Emma, were you involved in the search at all?
Yeah. So I was in this grad program at the same time. And so I was anchored to Kingston. And so both my sister and I did a lot of the online stuff. So Shelley knew she could call us to ask for anything. And so she would tell us what needed to get done. And then we would do sort of the back end of it. And then as soon as I had a break in school, which was in the winter, it was, you know, a winter break, my sister and I flew out west and went and sort of did our own search on the island, based on sort of where Shelley had been and where she had heard things. And we sort of went and tracked down a couple of tips that had come in. And actually we went to every library and thrift shop that we could get to on the island and put up posters and talked to people and, you know, met people who had sent in information and did it that way. But then when the week was done, I had to be back at school and my sister had to be back home as well. And so we came back now I just still do whatever Shelley needs.
Some people believe that it's likely that Emma's living a transient life somewhere, just not wanting to be found. You've already commented on it a bit, but knowing her as well as you do, can you picture her being off on her own this long without reaching out to her family or her younger brother or yourself?
I can't. I can't imagine her, you know, not sending an email, not calling. You know, both of our families have had actually the same landline phone number for as long as we've lived, right? These aren't like, they're not, they don't change. And so without reaching out, the other side to that is that I think that she was really unwell. And it's hard to know when your mental state has changed. Like, it's hard to know what you would know and what you wouldn't know. So I can't imagine sort of, you know, not after 4 years, right? The, like, whatever's fun in running off and going on an adventure, too much time has passed. I didn't think that's what she did in the first place, but I was always playing around with the different ideas in my head. Whenever I have dreams about Emma, it's that she's just gone on an adventure and she comes back and she's, you know, completely confused by everything that's happened. And I'm so, so furious in my dreams. In real life, I don't think that's possible.
Can you talk about how Emma's disappearance has affected the Filipovs?
I think they've all been affected by it in a way that their world will never go back. I think that each of them have found their own way to keep going forward with each day. But I think no matter what, we've all gone through a change that will sort of be with us forever.
Now, in your home with your family, how often is it that Emma's brought up, I'm assuming it, you must constantly have it play, the story playing out in your mind. How often is this something you're talking about now, almost 4 years later?
A lot. I don't live in Perth anymore, but I would say every time I'm home, we talk about it. My mom thinks about it every day. My dad probably the same. You know, my sisters and I, like, we talk about it, and when anything kind of comes up or changes, we'll let each other know about it. But like, you know, there's not that much that's changed. I think we all think about her all the time.
Now, although not a lot has changed in recent years, Emma's case and Shelley's search for her daughter has gotten a lot of attention through CBC's Fifth Estate and ongoing coverage from different places. Seeing as Emma was so private, what do you think she would think of this?
I think she would hate having, you know, her life talked about and pulled apart and the photos and her writing being out there. But I also think that she is such a sensitive person that the feelings of it would be bigger, right? Seeing all the people that she cares about hurting so much and just trying to find, you know, find ways to help her or find her, or Shelley just wants people to keep thinking and talking for that small chance that someone knows something or someone's seen something. And as her friend, you know, I have decisions to make about talking about her and in a way that if she was here, I would never do and she would never feel comfortable with. But I think I have to think that sort of the feelings of it come through stronger.
And I imagine a lot of your motivation, as is Shelley's, is that small possibility that she's out there somewhere and someone's going to be able to, you know, put these clues together and ultimately find her. Is that where your mind is going? Is just, you know, trying to do things to take advantage of that chance that she's out there and that this will lead back to her?
Yeah. I think that taking any chance that comes, I often follow Shelley's lead on, you know, if she asks me to do something, then I just do it. And then in my day-to-day life, I find that I just try to keep sort of moving forward and remembering the niceness and the richness that I've had with Emma in my life and know that any of the possibilities could be true.
In your mind, what do you think most likely has become of Emma?
I don't know. And I think it's fair to say that anybody who knows her doesn't know. Because in my head, it's almost like I have a pro con list for each of the options, and each of the options has as many things on the possibility side as not possible. So none of them stand out as the most likely, and you add in, you know, what we believe is mental illness and a mental breakdown, and it just throws all the pieces up in the air again. And you add in this, you know, this magnetism that she had, you know, just the desire for people to get to know her better, and all the pieces get thrown up again.
Now, this pro and con list you have of some of the different scenarios, could you tell me a few kind of scenarios and things that in your mind that would make them impossible?
Yeah, so the first one being around, you know, the transient lifestyle, and the things that are for it are, you know, her desire for a journey, her desire to be in the moment, and go with that moment and what she's feeling. And the cons are just the relationships she has in her life, the relationships with her family, with her siblings, with my family, with her other friends as well. Like, she has gone on adventures for a long time, and she always lets us know. The really big one on that side as well is that, like, she kept her important possessions close to her, and she left those things in her van, you know, things like her passport. This is something that she would keep on her even if she had no intention of leaving the country, because it's like, it's a security of knowing that you could. It's a security of, like, keeping those items really close. You know, these are her possessions. These are the things that are, like, that are stand-ins for her people, and are also her ways out of situations. You know, money, passport, ID. These are, like, the things you don't separate yourself from, and so that's a definitely a big one. In terms of her committing suicide, it is very, very hard to judge in terms of, like, just not knowing what her mental state was. On the other side, people who know her, you know, I think everyone has kind of agreed that it doesn't really fit with her. And there are just these back and forths for each one.
But ultimately, now going on 4 years since she was last seen, you're still scratching your head in the middle, not sure which is most likely.
Absolutely. I think it gets harder to believe that she left on her own will as years go on. It's also hard to think that there wouldn't be any change in her mental state, you know, that she wouldn't know who she was, where she was. As time goes on, I worry about her being taken against her will, and I worry about her being, you know, so mentally unwell that she wandered into a situation, even like into the woods or something, and wasn't able to get herself out.
Is there anything else you want to share with people who haven't had the chance to meet Emma? Anything you could share with us to give us a better idea of the type of person she was and the type of personality she has?
So I listened to all your episodes today in kind of thinking about this. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like, I listened to the one with Julian, and, like, he actually describes her quite well. As he's saying this, I'm kind of, like, nodding along, like, kind of, you know, laughed at one part or two, because it's, you know, he describes her, and he describes even, like, her at her dad's house, like, very accurately, better than I would be able to. The hardest thing to convey is that Emma is a whole lot of different things. I'm always trying to sort of paint the picture of who she is. And it's so hard, you know. I say, oh, she was, you know, quite transient, but also very grounded by her relationships. And I think that, you know, she was silly and goofy and loving and also private and secretive. And then we throw in, you know, paranoid, right? And the words just don't quite do justice to describe and explain who she is. And so I hope by, you know, you getting to talk to a couple of her friends that we're able to sort of put more pieces of the puzzle together. And I think that it's from getting those different perspectives that you start to kind of piece together both who she is and also why it's so difficult to make any guesses on what happened.
That will conclude tonight's episode of the Nighttime Podcast. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in joining the Nighttime Patron Group. It's $1 a month, and it gives you access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. On behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of my current patrons and welcome the newest members of the group, Elliot, Ben, Paul, Brooke, Elizabeth, and Mr. Shag Harbor, Brock Zink. Without you all, the production of this show would be impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes or whichever other podcast platform you use. To stay up to date, please visit my site, nighttimepodcast.com. Follow me on Facebook. I'm also most active on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is @nighttimepod. And if you have any stories or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.